Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we were just talking about Guantanamo Bay. Now we'll turn a little further north on the island of Cuba, where on Sunday last weekend, July 11th, tens of thousands of people demonstrated across 45 cities in the largest anti-government protests on the island in decades, chanting freedom and chanting enough. The protests erupted amid Cuba's worst economic crisis since the fall of the Soviet Union way back when. The crisis was compounded by the ongoing pandemic, which has brought the island to the brink of its worst food shortages in decades. But the protests aren't limited to just on the island of Cuba. Since then, all across the United States, Cuban Americans and their allies have also gathered in solidarity. Joining us now to break down the ongoing situation in Cuba and to help take your phone calls are Dr. Andy Gomez, retired director of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies and a former assistant provost and dean of international studies at the University of Miami. Professor, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be with you.
And also joining us is Frances Robles, national and foreign correspondent for the New York Times. She was last on the show back in 2017 to discuss how Hurricane Irma affected the region. Frances, welcome back. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Brian.
And just by a little way of background, I gather the two of you actually go way back in Florida. Dr. Gomez, how do you two know each other?
Oh, Frances and I go back years. I think she's one of the best journalists I've had encountered in my years dealing with reporters across not only the United States, but around the world. She's a top journalist.
And with that as a very good entrance credit, Frances, what exactly are people in Cuba protesting and why now?
Well, thank you so much for those kind words, Andy, if I may call you Andy on the radio. Why now? You know, it's interesting. It's been such a confluence of factors. You know, you have the food factor, you have the medicine factor, you have the COVID factor. But for us to say, oh, people are, you know, I think one of the mistakes that some of the media, the national media has been making is saying, oh, people are protesting a lack of food and lack of medicine. And I don't think that's the case. I think it's all these confluence of factors making people say, enough, you know, what I want is democracy.
So, Professor, you were actually born in Cuba. Can you tell us about your family leaving? And you see this as simply for democracy? Because you know how this gets polarized in this country. People who support the economic embargo on Cuba that was in place for so long, and I guess the Trump administration renewed and reinforced after the Obama administration had eased it to varying degrees. People say if you're not for the economic embargo, then you're not for Cuba. You're soft on dictatorship, communist style. And on the other hand, people say we want to help the people of Cuba, so we want to lift the economic embargo or ease it. So how does that United States debate play into what's going on there now, or how you think people here should view it?
Well, let me begin by, yes, I was born in Cuba, and I left at the age of six in 1961, 3 days before the Bay of Pigs. My dad worked for Coca-Cola, so we were fortunate. He was transferred actually to Venezuela and later on to Miami, Florida. Brian, the issue of Cuba is somewhat complicated. No question, the protests that we saw on Sunday were unprecedented. We have not seen that level of protest, I would say, back to 1959, 1958, across the island. But, you know, one thing we have to take into consideration here, and I think by now we should have learned that we, the United States, cannot export democratic principle, democratic governments to countries that don't have a history for having them and sustaining them. What I mean by this, we have to look very carefully at Cuba's history. And I dare to say that Cuba did not have a democracy before 1959.
Meaning, even before Castro, they didn't have a democracy.
Even before Castro, I mean, we had a somewhat of a turbulent history in terms of governments, like most countries in Latin America. So, how does the United States get involved in all of this? Well, you know, we've had some of our local politicians, what I call, and I've told them, be a little bit irresponsible by calling for a military intervention of Cuba. And this is a very complicated world, as we all know. Let's just stay in Latin America. You have what the problem will happen in Haiti with the president being assassinated, Venezuela. Invading Cuba at this time doesn't really resolve the problems in the long run. You look at what happened in Iraq. We brought down the security apparatus, and then we ended up staying in the country for a long time. Look at Afghanistan. 20 years later, we're leaving, and now they continue to fight. So the issue in Cuba is here in South Florida, of course, and I understand that being Cuban, feeling it every single day, being sad to see the kind of hard repression that the people of Cuba are suffering under the totalitarian regime. But in the long run, unless the Cuban military turns on the leadership, I don't see the government falling.
So listeners, Cuban Americans, if we have any Cuban Americans listening right now, we invite you to call in and say anything you want about how you see the situation in Cuba right now, or what you would like the U.S. role to be, if any, as these pro-democracy protests rise on the island. 646-435-7280. Help us report this story, Cuban Americans, or anybody with a connection to Cuba, no matter what your background. What are you hearing from loved ones or business associates or whoever you have down there? What are they calling for? What have they been experiencing? Help us report this story. 646-435-7280. 646-435-7280. Maybe you went to one of the solidarity protests here in the United States. You can tell us about that experience. Again, anybody who's Cuban American or has a relationship with people in Cuba, 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280, or tweet your comment or question at Brian Lehrer. As we continue with our guests, Professor Andy Gomez, retired director of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies at the University of Miami, and New York Times correspondent Francis Robles. Francis, what's the situation today? It's starting to fall out of the news in the United States, more or less. But you heard Professor Gomez just say that he doesn't think the government is going to fall and the system is going to change unless the Cuban military turns on the government.
That's right. So for the first few days, what you saw was the Cuban government cutting the internet down. And so cutting the internet really was a successful way of quashing some of this, because it's the oxygen that these protests need to breathe. I mean, people were hitting the streets because they saw other people hitting the streets. And so if you cut people's abilities to film Facebook Live, then that really, you know, hampers the effort, the movement. And then the fact that hundreds of people are in jail, I mean, that's obviously also going to hamper the movement. And people have a second thought. It's like, wait a second, am I going to be committing a crime, a quote unquote crime that's going to land me in jail for years? I have a question for Dr. Gomez. I'm curious to know what you think of this. You know, under the Obama administration, it was all about money, people, and ideas to Cuba, flood the zone, and that thing that will get the government to fall. And now you see, after a period of like really, really tight restrictions, and then pandemic bringing even worse restrictions, finally brings thousands of people to the street. I'm curious to know if you think that this vindicates the embargo in some way.
Well, you know, Frenchie, the embargo is a negotiation tool. And we tried, when President Obama opened relations with Cuba, to sit down with the Cubans, which, by the way, I should say, we caught the Cuban government off guard to some extent, what Obama did. The embargo needs to be negotiated. There are many other issues that need to be put on the table, but the Cuban government keeps putting the issue of lifting the embargo and giving back Guantanamo Bay, the base. We got to start somewhere else. We got to start somewhere else. And the Cuban government really, at this point, has shown very little indication that they're willing to come to the table in good faith and negotiate. There's no question, and I give you, there's no question that the embargo has had a negative impact on the Cuban people, number one. Number two, I don't know of any economic embargo that has brought down a regime in the past. Nevertheless, I think the issues are bigger, and I do hope that in the near future, both the United States and Cuba will come to the table and begin to renegotiate many of the issues that need to be addressed.
Francis, did you get that answer, the answer you were looking for? Did that advance the story?
I guess that if this was an interview between you and me, I would pin you down and say,
pin me down.
Yes or no.
Pin me down.
I'm pinning you down. Does
pin me
this
down.
Mean
I know you well,
that the people who were for the embargo, does this protest movement prove that they were right? That you had to squeeze them financially in order to bring on a social uprising?
No, I really don't, Frenchie. I think what we saw in Cuba last Sunday, and the Cuban people are very clear. The problems in Cuba are not the economic embargo, the U.S. economic embargo. The problems in Cuba is almost 63 years of totalitarian regime, denying them their freedom, denying them the right to choose, denying them the right to travel. So this is more complicated than just the embargo. I approach the embargo from an academic point of view, which is what I've been trained. And in diplomatic negotiations, you don't give up something for nothing. And that's my point.
Jose in Union City, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jose.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me speak, Brian. I am a Cuban-American. I've been in this country for 40 years, but I've never lost contact with my country and my roots, and I know everything about the situation. I would just like to commend the station for letting us express our views, which is the main problem in Cuba. This is not about the embargo. We shouldn't even be talking about the embargo or even the hunger that my people are going through right now. This is all about one thing. They are yelling libertad, liberty. It's very clear what they want. It's 62 years of communist oppression where you can't do what we do here freely. As we speak, people are being beaten out of their homes, jailed, and killed simply for doing what we can do in this country. That is all this demonstration is about. We've had enough. Me having lived here for 40 years, I consider myself a Cuban-American. But all the people of Cuba have had enough of communist dictatorship. And I know that most of the listeners will not be in agreement because they idolize Fidel and all this other garbage.
Well, I wouldn't
a
say
little history
that's
lesson.
True.
There was
but go
a
ahead.
Democracy in Cuba before Batista idiotically took over with a coup d'etat. That was a dictatorship as well. But before that, we had a democracy. Not perfect, just like our democracy here. It's not perfect, but we did have a democracy before Batista.
Jose, how do we get there, in your opinion? How does the current movement succeed, and what role, if any, for the United States?
Yes. Unfortunately, the only solution is for bloodshed in Cuba itself. Make it clear, one point, Cubans have no arms whatsoever. Their only weapon is speech. And their only weapon is for the rest of the world to support them. As far as a military intervention, it's not going to happen. It's a pipe dream of the Cuban community. And I don't even know if it's the correct thing to do, a military intervention by the U.S. But
right.
We can help in many other ways. Beginning with information and the truth being set out. Every time I turn on a station, they're talking about the embargo or COVID or this or that, and they don't say what it is. Dictatorship where people can't do anything freely. Freedom. And we have to acknowledge that. Everyone has to acknowledge that. All you like the reality.
Jose, thank you so much. I think we do say dictatorship on the station, but nevertheless, thank you very much for all of that. And I'm going to go on to another caller. Here's Charles from Miami, who says he's a first-generation Cuban-American. Charles, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hey, Brian. This is such a pleasure, man. What's up, dude? How's it going? I'm originally from Miami, Florida.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
I'm originally from Miami. I live in Jersey. I have a cousin out in Cuba who I message over Facebook Messenger, every here and there and this, that, and the other. And I saw that everything was heating up over there, things were getting protests and stuff like that. So I sent her a message in Spanish basically saying, oye, eso se está calentando, it's getting hot over there. And she messaged me back an article from the Miami Herald, and she was like, no, that's not us. That's you guys over there. So, I don't know what to think. I know what to think. I know Cuba needs to be, free. Those people need to be free. There's mixed emotions over there, too.
What do you mean it's you guys over there? It's not the Cubans. Explain that.
Right. So meaning like the Americans, us Americans, right? So I'm American. I was born and raised in Miami, Florida. I'm bilingual. I love this country. I live in Jersey now.
Uh-huh.
And, I'm an American. So, but my opinion of Cuba is, they need to get out of that dictatorship. You know what I'm saying? They need to step into 2021. You know what I mean? So, to her over there, she's like, well, no, that's your American sentiment. We don't think that over here.
And Charles, I'm gonna leave it there. I really appreciate your call. Do call us again. So Francis Robles from the New York Times, what do you think about, either of those two callers, but the point that Charles was just making there, that people on the island are divided about whether they would want this government to fall and this system of government to change?
I don't think there's any question that there is whatever percent core group of people who support the government for whatever reason, because their personal situation, their family situation improved tremendously. They believe in socialism. They have some personal benefit to the government staying in power. Sure, there's X percent that feels that way. But to Charles's cousin, I would say, that she opened the window and look outside last weekend. Because no matter what city she was in, there's a pretty good chance that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people out there. Now, is there another core group of people in the United States, Cuban exiles, who are helping nudge this thing along? Sure. I think that we would be deluding ourselves to think otherwise. I don't know, Andy, if you agree.
I agree.
That was easy. Maria in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a Cuban American who was born and raised in Miami, Florida, but now in Brooklyn. Kind of the younger generation. My dad is from Cuba and kind of left Cuba when the Castro regime took over. And, we were always told growing up, that obviously communism is bad and the dictatorship is a big issue, but the younger generation also sees the issue with the embargo. Yes, the dictatorship is more than half to blame, but I think a small percentage is, I think the embargo needs to go. It's not working. It's not doing anything to help the situation whatsoever. And I also think that possibly the military needs to get involved. The Cuban people don't have much power, so them rising up alone, and now they're getting bashed down by the local police and military. I'm not very hopeful that them rising up right now is going to do a whole lot unless outside sources get involved.
You're calling for U.S. military intervention in Cuba?
U.S. or any other country that wants to help out.
Maria, thank you very much. But Professor Gomez,
right,
that certainly didn't work when they tried it in 1961, right?
No. Can I jump in real quickly?
Of course.
Let me give a concrete example about the embargo. When President Obama opened up relationships with Cuba and encouraged American and Cuban-American foreign investment, I spoke to many of lawyers and companies that looked at Cuba as a possibility of investing. and the United States was going to allow it. Here's the problem. The Cuban government and their economy, which most of it is controlled by the military, wants to control 51% plus of the investments. There's no one in their right frame of mind that would want to invest in Cuba when you do not also have legal assurances that your money is going to be protected and safe, and it's going to mean something. We have seen, beginning with the early days of the revolutions, companies that were confiscated. Since then, a number of individuals that invested in Cuba lost everything. So it's very easy to lift the embargo, is my point. But the Cuban government needs to also change many of their restrictions in order for the uses of lifting the embargo to work for the Cuban people.
And we are going to have to leave it there with Andy Gomez, retired director of the Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies and former assistant provost and dean of international studies at the University of Miami, and Frances Robles from the New York Times, who we now know her nickname is Frenchie because Dr. Gomez is so familiar with her that he calls her by that nickname. And Frances, thank you very much for being co-journalist with me on this segment and interviewing Professor Gomez along the way. So
thank you for letting me hijack your show, Brian. I've always wanted my own radio show.
That was fabulous. And callers, we could, if we had more time, we could keep taking some more of you who are Cuban American. So we will do that another day as we continue to follow this situation. Professor and Francis, thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks,
Brian
Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, a proposal for a 4-day work week. Stay tuned.